Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Partying and making music about partying for partying for partiers.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This week, we talk to Prof. Jacob Prof. Anderson is a Minneapolis-based rapper whose fun and deceptively intricate tracks and entertaining, sometimes chaotic live shows have been entertaining fans since the mid-2000s. He has an outsized comic persona, but that doesn't stop him from frequently rapping movingly and artfully about his difficult childhood and family life. Prof quickly rose through the hip-hop ranks in his hometown and is one of only a handful of rappers, local or otherwise, who can sell out Minneapolis's biggest venues. His success led him to joining forces with the city's preeminent hip-hop label, Rhymesayers. Prof's debut album on the label, Liability, drops this week. We talked to him from Crosstown Studios in Harlem in the middle of a busy press run in advance of the album's release. If you enjoy The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 110, where we talk to another Rhymesayers alum, Blueprint. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, here's that guy whose balls you saw on the internet, Prof.
I just burped really loud on the Sway Show on live TV. And he was like, whoa, that's crazy. I was like, I don't know. That's kind of like my shit. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. I've seen like some of the party video. Was it your 27th birthday? Some of the videos like that where you were sort of had some antics with you and your friends.
This girl seen me spitting in the food. Our food's boom be spitting. She gonna spit on my clam strips.
I'm gonna pour this whole thing in your hands.
Yeah, I broke my back that day. So that was cool. Yeah.
How did you during the show?
During the filming of that 27th birthday thing, that night, you know, just running around afterwards, I think I fell off a garage or something, or, you know, just jumping.
I would say, but you have a habit of jumping into odd places.
I have a bad history of doing that. So, you know, knee surgery, back surgery, you know, hernia surgery, you know, so basically a lot of surgeries in the past 5 years. So that's my record has taken 3 years to put out since my last one.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because, like, some of those injuries, you know, like you said, are from kind of, you know, playing around.
All preventable.
a lot of them are from the live show.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or from, you know, like you said, the knee surgery and hernias and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about adjusting your performances at all to, like, limit that?
I mean, yeah. I went back on the road for my knee surgery. The recuperation time was like 8 weeks to 12 weeks. And on the very day of eight weeks, I was out on stage and I blew my back out again because my back was kind of, they were both kind of happening a little bit at the same time. Right. So, then after that, we were like, man, you know, we can't be having this happen. You know, like you got to get good. A lot of people have like money, time invested. And, you know, if I kept doing that, you know, it's hard to start a career when you're always in the hospital.
Sure. So have you cut down on the stage diving?
Yeah, mostly because I have in-ears now, my in-ear pieces. You know what I'm saying? So if I jump out there, the cords get ripped. And, you know, I had a show with Atmosphere. It's like a sold out show, like 2000 people. And some girl was just like, and just, you know, reached up and just yanked the cord out. And I'm like, everything stops. I'm like, bitch, I'm like, Fundo, stop the music. I'm like, dude, if you start unplugging things like in the show's going to stop. Like, I don't know what you're thinking. So I was like, I really can't be jumping in the crowd with those on. Sometimes at the end of shows, I'll just rip them off in the last couple songs. I'll still do that. But I think what I've stopped a little bit was like the after show, you know, jumping off of like car garages and into rivers and stuff.
Into packages of vegetables in supermarkets.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. I read something you were saying about like the difference between kind of the shows and the meet and greets.
Yeah.
Which was like the shows, you said, okay, you do them, you know, mostly sober or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the meet and greets, at least, you know, when you were giving this interview, you said, you know, everyone's drunk, everyone's buying you shots. And so you end up trashed pretty much at every meet and greet. Is that kind of still the case?
Yeah, that's kind of right on. It's like there's been a time, a couple meet and greets where I'm just like, I'm not drinking. And I get back there and people are like, ah, you know, they've waited a month for me to get there. And I'm like, I was just drinking last night, the night before. So, and they're like smiling and I'm like trying to smile, but I'm like, I'm just not on your level. And they're like, well, what's wrong with you? And they're looking at me. I'm like, well, you can't fake it on your face and you're just drowning. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I get that feeling. I'm like, these people are so, some of them are so annoying. Like they'll reach their hand around you with the beer and like spill on you and shit. And I'm like, I don't know how I'm not going to punch someone in the face. So like, it's still hard for me to go out there. Not, you know, usually I'll go back stage and take a couple shots, take a deep breaths, take a couple shots and get back out there and start talking to people.
Yeah. I mean, you hit on this dynamic I've noticed in touring musicians a lot, which is, you know, it's your job, but for the people you're seeing every single night, like you said, it's something they're looking forward to for a month or two, or since the last time you were in town, you know, maybe they have the next day off work. It's like a party for them.
Or they traveled, you know what I mean? Or they've traveled 14 hours. Like some people drive stupid amounts of time and money and they invest so much shit into it. It's like, that's ridiculous to me. You know what I mean? I still feel humbled from that. And I want to give people the experience that they're looking for. But sometimes it just kills me. You know what I mean? So you just got to take care of your body as much as you can, really.
Yeah. So you have, you know, Liability, the new album, you know, as we're talking, coming out very soon.
Yeah.
So your previous albums, you've given away, you know, tens of thousands of copies when you add up, you know, all the stuff you gave out
over,
on tour.
Over 100,000 or 200,000, something crazy like that.
Wow. Yeah. When you add out all the copies you've given out on tour and downloads and the four or five projects over a bunch of years.
Yeah.
How is it different to think, you know, just even to conceive of like, oh, this is an album I have to sell?
It's weird, man. The other day I was in a car, like riding in the back seat, and someone had a huge, you know, the album booklet, you know, the 4x4, just really thick. And I'm like, I'm looking at Fundo. I'm like, look at this. Look at this old school stupid shit. Like, look at all this dude's CD collection. And then it dawned on me, I'm like, I'm trying to sell these. Like, that's really weird, you know. But, I mean, most of my revenue is still going to come from, like, live shows and whatever. I mean, I guess it's just like an added, you know, piece of revenue that'll come in, you know. Yeah. But it still kind of sucks that, like, labels and magazines are still looking at like record sales as some sort of official, you know, gauge, some litmus test, you know what I'm saying? And I don't know if that's completely the right way to do it anymore, but I still would like to sell a lot of records to show people like, hey, you know, just to turn some heads maybe and be like, I'm here, you know what I mean? Just even if a few hundred thousand million, whatever.
Right. Did you think about it any differently because it's, you know, for rhymesayers, because it's something you're selling, like in the actual process of making it, did you approach it differently than any of the other tapes?
Never. Everything I do, I do it because it excites me. If I hear a beat, if I don't like it, I throw it away. Next. If I'm writing to it, if I don't like it, I throw it away. Like I never make a song being like, what would this target market think of this in this industry over on this side? And, you know, like, that's way too much. My soul would die. And I mean, if everybody knew exactly what to make, everybody would be a superstar.
Sure, everyone,
you know what I'm saying?
So
everybody would have the fucking the formula to it. So I might as well just make stuff I like that's just for me, you know?
Yeah. So I wanted to jump back for a second to kind of the beginnings of you performing in Minneapolis. I've heard you talk about a place called the Dinky Towner that was kind of the center of the whole scene. What was so special about that place?
You've done some research. I think it's kind of like it wasn't really lots of famous things going on. Like, nothing really crazy blew up out of it. Like, you know, in New York, you got a couple select venues here and there, and then it's just world famous because this person came out of that. That was happening at the Dinky Towner, you know what I mean? But it was smaller level. It was DIY, you know. But people were getting together. That was the spot. I would go there three, four times a week and just get drunk and just battle people. Like, hood motherfuckers were there, backpackers were there. We'd all go there, you know, sharpen our knives. It was a small, grimy venue, so you could perform there. There was a Saturday show that was thrown that was every single Saturday. So all the local rappers would come and have their Saturday. And it was good. You know, nowadays in Minneapolis, that's not around.
There's not one place where nowadays
I think people will get scooped up and like signed to labels even out of Minneapolis now. Like even like they'll release they like someone says, oh shit, they got like 10,000 listens on this one track over here on SoundCloud. Boom, like they would get signed up now. There isn't like one venue that we'll go to when people would just like culturize, you know. It's like it's on the internet now, you know. So I don't think people get together like they were doing back then. And I'm happy that I was, you know, probably one of the last people that were like, you know, doing that out of Minneapolis.
And I heard about something you used to do there called drunk shows.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, we did those, we had to stop those. we would throw a show. There wasn't like a backstage there. And at this time we were kind of cracking, you know, like there was, I think the sellout there was like 400 or something like that. And we were selling it out. And the idea to these shows was you come, we were going to kick it. There won't be any other acts. And we'll drink at the bar. You buy me these shots. I will drink everything. I won't refuse a drink, you know. Show will start when my partner at the time, Roswell, when he throws up, we'll get on stage. So it was bad. It was really bad. So he threw up in a bucket and it was on. And it was really sloppy. We had this huge, we had our set list behind us that was written on a, you know, like a 3 by 9 foot sheet. So we just look back and remember it. And I don't really remember much. I remember, I'm always into my craft and I want to hit those notes. I want to get those syllables. And I remember there was one time I was like, okay, you know, I'm chopping, I'm going fast. And I was just like, my lips didn't work. And I'm like, oh, fuck it, I'm drunk. And I just jumped out there. And I remember being like, I felt like I had like whiskey dick in front of everybody. You know, like if that's the reason they're coming to see this show, like they're not going to get that, you know? Yeah. And so the drunk three is when we stopped. I pulled down my pants, showed my asshole, like bent over, like spread my ass cheeks, and then jumped into the crowd bottomless. And then like the next day it was like on Facebook and shit. Like, and I'm like, I didn't remember that at all. Like I remember getting on stage. Like I couldn't get on stage. The stage is like 4 feet tall. I remember someone rolling me on a stage like a hot dog. Ta-da! Like I'll start the show, you know? And yeah. I saw that and I'm seeing my balls all over the internet and shit. And I'm like, can't do this again, you know? And Fundo, my DJ, woke up behind the turntables in that venue at like 6 in the morning, you know, when they were like reopening, like, I don't, you know, so we had to stop that, you know?
Yeah. I was just going to ask if you'd ever seen any video of any of those shows. And it seems like maybe you have.
Yeah. I mean, I had those pictures deleted, but I haven't seen videos from those shows in years. I don't know.
Yeah. So when you were growing up, it seemed like you kind of lived in two different places with your dad in kind of a poor area. And then with your mom and stepfather in a richer
Hills.
Area.
Yeah.
So how did being in both those worlds affect you?
I don't know. Linden Hills was like, it's right by Lake Harriet. I mean, it's still like in the city, but it's super nice. And I would like go fishing in the mornings and shit, like on the weekends, you know, I'd be fishing with my stepbrother. And I mean, Powderhorn, that's like who I am. You know what I mean? Like I didn't make it out to Linden Hills when my mom moved in with my stepdad out there until I was like, I don't know, 13 or something like that.
Kind of your formative years were.
Yeah. I mean, my, you know, the house is still there. You know what I'm saying? The family house is still there. And so that's what I always like repped. There wasn't any moving there. That's like definitely what shaped me. But out there it was like, nature like gave me a sense of like, I wake up early and like go fishing out there. And then I think that's where I like going out and like canoeing and shit, you know? So, but I mean, even out there, we were in a triplex, you know what I'm saying? A lot of people would be like, man, that dude's rich. He grew up in Linden Hills. And like, I'll see that, you know, on the internet and be like, man, fuck, man. I lived in a triplex. And in Linden Hills, my room was cut off by a wall. My brother had the other room and I had this room and I didn't have any fucking heat in that room. In the middle of winter, I had like a lava lamp and a 40. It was just like a... You know, I made it myself from like oil and water and you just tip it over. And it like busted and froze all over my fucking bed because it was like below 30 degrees in my room. You know, so I'm like, you know, it is what it is. But yeah, it was a totally different dichotomy for sure.
Mm-hmm. And your father, you know, you've rapped a lot about him in your songs and some of his issues. For people who might not have heard those tunes, might not be familiar with your music, can you tell us a little bit about what he was like?
Oh, man, that's such a crazy question. He was a crazy, braggadocious. I mean, he was a preacher. So, I mean, he's a rapper. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's just like me. You know, that's where I get my stage presence from. He was like the craziest, most fun dude. Like, we'd be going to the grocery store in his car, and it was just a junker car, and he'd say this thing, he'd be like, agadi, 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 and just step on the gas, and there'd be a woman holding her groceries, and he'd be going like as fast as he could, like 40, 50 miles an hour directly at her, and then go skrr, and then go the other way, and I'd just be clapping and laughing like, yeah, you know, as a kid, and you know, like, that's him. And then we went to McDonald's, and he saw some dudes throwing garbage out the window as they left. And he was like, those fucking assholes, you know. He was like, go inside. I went inside with my stepmom and my family. And then I look out, you know, and I see his jacket, his red reflective gopher's jacket, like, bouncing around. And he's, like, fighting six or seven dudes at the same time. And he, like, seriously lumped up, came in all fucked up, you know, like. He would flip like he was bipolar, and he was weird in and out of these medications and shit, you know. So he was the most fun. There was a time where I was laughing with him, and my stepmom was sleeping because she was a nurse, and he was making jokes. But then he was like, yo, be quiet, you know, she's sleeping. And then we were just laughing again, and he was having a bunch of fun. And I said, hey, Dad, be quiet, she's sleeping. And he was just laughing. Boom, he snapped, grabbed me by my neck, beat the shit out of me, punched me, dragged me down out to the porch, and threw me down the stairs outside, you know? So that's Neil Anderson. And yeah, he's not around right now.
Sure.
Yeah. He ended up dying on a stationary bike at the YMCA of a heart attack.
Wow.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's intense. Yeah.
I got some really weird, crazy stories.
Yeah. I mean, you have, you know, you mentioned in multiple songs about how he burned down his own house.
I want to talk to him, a murderer, kingpin, arson. I want to hear him soft-spoken. Something that I'll never have is something that I want the most. If I can't pedal, I'll coast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was probably what shaped, you know, my life. That was like a big pillar, you know, like I had to make a couple decisions after that. At that time, I was, I think, 14 or 15 years old. His arguments were crazy, you know. He was the fun, like I said, the most fun person. But then sometimes, like, I was figuring out, like, growing up and into a young man, I was like, I'm pretty sure this is not right. You know, this is pretty fucked up. And so we had a big-ass fight. And I stood up for myself, like, for real, in the living room. You know, my stepmom was watching it all, and it was super intense. And then I left. And then just a cool off steam. And then I'm like, all right, I'm coming back just like an hour or two later, and I'm calling the house. And it's just a busy signal. So I'm like, whatever. And I have my friend's mom drop me off. Woodling. Anna Woodling's mom dropped me off. Or maybe her dad. This is crazy. I'm getting into depth. And then I'm like, he's dropped me out there. Because this is before cell phones and shit, you know. And there's police all up and down the block. Fire trucks all up and down the block. And I'm just like, that was kind of normal. So I'm like, just drop me off here. Like, I want to see what's going on. So I'm like running, you know, trying to see like a murder or something. And the closer I get to it, you know, the smoke everywhere. There's like, there's a lot more fire trucks I'm figuring out. And all of a sudden, like, I'm the first one back at this house. And everybody else was gone, you know what I mean, at the time. So I'm riding up there, like, there's flames coming out of this fucking thing, like out of the basement and shit where he started it. And there's just huge firemen running back and forth. And it's like it's in a fucking movie. I'm sitting there in the front yard. Like, I'm kind of like trying to get someone's attention, and they're not paying attention to me. And I'm in the front yard, like, probably way too close through the lines and everything. I'm like screaming on my knees just like it's in a movie. Like, what the fuck is going on? I'm like shaking and shit. And they're like, you know, someone was probably like, you got to go over here. And I didn't really lose it, you know. I was still like held together a little bit. And then my older sister came. Ugh, when she came back, she was like, her fucking curdling fucking cry to me when she hugged me. She was shaking. And she was like, I think she said something like, fucking dad did this or something. Like, I can't believe it. And I'm like, I didn't really want to think. I didn't really want to go way into it like that. I was just like, still kind of numb, like the house is on fire. And she was just screaming, shaking. I felt her body moving. And I was like, fuck, yeah, this is bad, you know. And we had like animals in there and shit that died, you know. But no one died. Everybody was out of the house.
Wow. Did he ever explain why he did it?
Man, that's the fucking, this is like a therapy session, but that's like the fucking, the hardest thing in my life to come to is right when I was starting to like grow up and be a man in my 20s and shit, he died before I really wanted to be like, grab him by his shoulders and sit him down and be like, all right, I'm grown now. I'm not going to take any shit. Let's have a real conversation about this. And he died before that, you know? So that all that hectic part of my life is unresolved, you know?
And you wrote the song about it myself. You wrote after his passing.
Now, Papa and the devil sitting in the basement. ARSONING. Young son headed back to the household. Running down the block, 8 fire trucks deep. Fell to my knees and I screamed in the front yard. Firemen running around like no one's in charge. Sort of like when it rains, it pours. See the flames burst out of the door. I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that song is like super intense. And I wrote that song, man, it was just super private. And I just cried over it. And it was just for me. And then I showed some of my homies that. And they're like, oh my God. They're like, it just hurt them too. And they're like, you gotta put this out. So I was like, fine, I'll fucking put it out. But I'm never performing it live. And then I performed it live. And fucking started crying, you know, a small show. And everybody else was fucking crying. They were like, and then it was like, we were connected forever. There, and so now I fucking perform that show, that song almost every time. Oh. So it's like, yeah, when I do this live show, it's like, I go way up and way down. It's like, I have to relive that shit, you know, every night.
Yeah. I remember talking to an actor about that. It was a guy who was in a play, a musical, where what shapes his character is that his brother gets killed very early in the play.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, you know, well, it's great to be in this play, but I have to actually feel that my brother dies every single night, and, you know, twice on Sundays or whatever. And it was a way I'd never thought about acting. And it seems like you feel that way about performing that song.
If you really, in every single song, I'm putting myself in that song. That's why I love, you know, performing live. The party songs, I'm really feeling good. You know, in the blues songs, I'm really feeling soulful, and it, you know, it's a release. And but you know, these other fucking crazy downer songs, like I'm really fucking right there. Like, and I would say 90% of the time, like I still perform myself. I still have goosebumps on my arms. Like you could see my goosebumps on stage, and I could probably fucking cry every time I perform that track.
My papa got some big anger problems.
I'm getting older and I'm sick about it. It's getting harder just to live around it. I need to take a stand as a man. I need to be a fighter, ring around the posy round.
But, you know, like you were saying, you obviously have a ton of party songs you do as well.
Yeah.
Some of the ways you write your songs seem to kind of lend themselves to the live performance a bit. You have like chants and breakdowns and, mm-hmm. you know, sort of extended sections like that, almost kind of like a dance music vibe in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
Make a couple stories. First we having fun. First we getting crunk. Put your both hands up and sing it with me now.
Buddy. Yeah, buddy.
If you feel me?
Buddy.
When you write stuff like that, are you thinking like, oh, this is going to go great when I perform it live? Is that like, does that figure
into the writing?
I don't
write it for live. I don't write shit for live.
Yeah.
Which maybe I should, because there's a track off of it that I try to perform live off of Liability. That's new.
Mm-hmm.
Love Like Mine. And I sing this. I hit this note that's like fucking impossible. So I'm like, man, maybe I should think about that. Because I always want to stretch my limits and my boundaries and, you know, and what I'm capable of every record. And this last record, there's a couple notes in Love Like Mine, a track that is one of my favorites off of it. That's if I perform it, it has to be the very first song, because otherwise my vocal cords just can't fucking hit it. I can't get it. But as far as those party joints, like, I'm not thinking about it live. Like, I'm thinking, you know, some of those chants and shit. Like, I was at a show in the Claremont Lounge in Atlanta, where it's a strip club with a bunch of old women run it, and they like push you in the face and like, you know, rub their vagina on you and like smoke and shit, and like a bunch of dude, like, they're doing cocaine in the bathroom and shit. It's like my favorite place. But there was one time where we ordered like 30 PBRs, like 30 or 4 beers, and we just, we're in the corner and we just cracked these fucking things, and we got some hot ass girls with us too from Atlanta, and we're just pouring beers all over ourselves, and we start like chanting "We in public," like, "We in public, we in public," and we just, and like, my memories of that, and like when people get together just and start chanting weird shit, you know, it could be like a soccer fans, you know, they just get together and they fucking, they sing the same thing, and they share the same like exuberance and joy, you know what I mean? Like, so when I'm doing that, I'm just thinking about people getting together, you know, doing the same thing.
Yeah. And then you have, you know, Animal, I'm thinking of particularly, where you have the chant that goes on at the end, and then in the video you actually turn it into a dance.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is pretty funny.
Prof was his name, oh, bingo. Wonder why I move like a gringo. Got a little dance and it goes like this, yo. Start lined up like someone shooting a free throw. Line them up, look them down. Pick them up, take them out. Hit them up, lay it on. Take it off, start again. Line them up, look them down. Pick them up, take them out. Hit them up, lay it on. Take it off, start again. Line them up, look them down.
Yeah, I like weird little dances too. You know, I'm not too cool for that shit. I like it.
So, one of the things I wanted to ask was, like, getting into the Rhymesayers thing. You've known those guys for a while now.
Yeah.
This is your first record with them, but you know, been on part of their tours for a very long time. How did you first cross paths with them?
I don't even remember, dude. Yeah. It's like, I don't remember, like, meeting most of these dudes. Like, I mean, I know I met probably the Dinky Towner, really. Mm. Like, over a decade ago, maybe, met Ant. I don't remember meeting Slug. I don't know. Just, like, they're just here now. I don't remember a time when I met any of them.
Yeah. And then you were part of their Welcome to Minnesota tour. Was that like four or five years ago?
Yeah.
The first one?
That was big for me. That helped me kind of like blow up in Minnesota. I was already kind of really bubbling, you know, radiating out of the cities, you know, so like the suburbs and Duluth and like these weird small cities that New York don't give a fuck about. But I was starting to bubble up over there. And so to get in front of like bigger crowds with atmosphere and to smash too was like a big like solidifying shit.
Yeah. You know, now that you're kind of part of the label officially, how do you think you fit with kind of the rest of the artists on the roster?
I don't think I fit. So that's cool.
how do you mean? I mean, I can imagine what I'm curious to hear.
Some of my fans were fucking angry that I did the sign with them, and a lot of their fans were angry that I signed with them. You know, it's like, I think, like, if you were to categorize each camp and kind of, like, stereotype each one, Rhymesayers would be, like, the backpack and true school nerdy. I would be, like, the fucking douchebag, scumbag America fucking, you know, kind of pop music asshole. You know, so I was already kind of set on not signing the Rhymesayers and, you know, continuing to do our own thing with Stop House and Mike and Dylan. But then I started talking to Sadiq, and they're like a true label. They just want the artists to do what the artists want to do. And that's just who they had at that time. And that's what they wanted to say at that time. Like, right. So Sadiq was like, man, you know, I want you to do whatever the fuck you want. And every little piece of content I come to these meetings with, I'm like, yo, the titties are out in this video. Like, what do you think of this? And Sadiq's like, that's it? Come on, man. Like, I thought you'd like, bring it. I'm like, what? Fuck. All right. You know? So, like, the very first single that we released, I was like, okay, like, put out the reply. Like, put out is the title of it. Mm. And it was just fucking awful. Like, it was like, fuck you, suck my dick, I'm the greatest. Like,
been with your baby mama, motherfucking cute daughter. Don't make me bring her toys out. Motherfuckers know I get intense like Boy Scouts. I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest. Don't front. I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest. Bitch, please. I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest. Fuck you.
Really, like, just to test, like, if you really want to do this, like, how, you know, how much of a rope can I have over here?
Yeah.
And he was like, do whatever the fuck you want. So, like, in a true sense of the word, like, they're a real, real label that just wants the artists to do whatever they want and just flourish and grow. And, you know, I'm just really have a lane that just hasn't been filled up to that point yet at Rhymes.
Yeah, and you have the new single and video Ghost with Tech N9ne.
Yep. Come to think about it, I'm a ghost. Some people believe in Bibles. Some believe in something that their eyes don't know. So I'm about to tell you how the psycho go. Okay? I've been swimming uphill for a decade plus. By the time I'm done, I'll be one of the best they was. It's like the country walking over a billion barrels of oil. They ain't even find me because of the mud. Find out prophets and ghosts. And, you know, the video just looks like... I was curious about the filming of that because it looked like you guys are having so much fun.
For people who haven't seen it, you two play Hitman in the video with a, you know, a... guy, you know, disguise of, you know, very, very thinly disguised, like, business to, you know,
yeah, painter suits route. To, like, yeah. Hardware dudes, repairmen and stuff.
Right. It just, it looked like you were having a lot of fun.
Yeah. I was surprised with how much fun Tech was having. So we were in there and he was like, man, this is like a movie, you know, like, he's just used to, he was like, I mean, I just get up there and spit, like, you know, he's like, now we're like moving, having this plot move through this house to assassinate this character, you know. So and we got Mac Lethal, the pancake rapper. Yellow cheese, eggs, white pancake batter. Put a little bit up on the skillet when it starts to bubble. Flip it over with your spatula. Yeah, yeah, that shit look like my breakfast. I gotta remember to flip the motherfucker over after cooking it for 30 seconds. Ladies love me. Yeah, we got him being killed in Kansas City by Tech N9ne making pancakes, which is like Kansas City history, you know. So that was fun.
That's amazing. And, you know, generally, as far as popularity goes, I feel like you're in an interesting spot because you've sold out basically every show, every venue in Minneapolis that you possibly could. First Avenue, you know, like a couple thousand seaters in Minneapolis and the surrounding areas, and even kind of like five or six states in that region. And then there's some national profile on the coast, but it's not nearly as big.
Completely, man. Like, I don't know of any other artist right now that's like... I've sold out to Caboose Outdoors, which is 4,000 people. You know what I'm saying? So that, you know, headlining that, and then, you know, you put me in a show in Philadelphia. I'm not really quite sure what'll happen. You know, so I mean, we're hoping coming out here to New York and, you know, doing stuff like this with you, and, you know, Sway in the Morning, and just trying to get these blogs on track. Like, we know for sure that the people will come to these cities and these shows. After I hit him up a couple times, like it doesn't fail, you know? So we're just trying to spread that to other cities. And then, you know what I'm saying? Trying to, in this record, I'm really just trying to get like nationally recognized.
Yeah.
Is my goal.
And, you know, looking at your catalog, something kind of struck me, which is like, there's not a lot of references to other rappers, to other songs, interpolations or quotes or things that, you know, some artists will do a ton of.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost none of that. And the little bit of it that there is, probably about 80% of it is Jay-Z. But if ever I write, I need the space to say whatever I like. Like, whenever I like, whenever I write, I need the space to say whatever I'd like, right? Hey. So I guess I kind of wanted to ask about both those things. Why isn't there a ton of that? And then why Jay?
I don't know. I guess it's all subconscious. When I'm writing something, I don't think like, all right, to this song, do I want to mention somebody? Or like, do I have a throwback over here or there?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I would say it's probably because Jay's in my top five, you know. I don't even know what the fuck my top five is, but I know Jay's there, M is there, and I'm there three times. So, I think Jay-Z really... I think M can make a run at him, but I think Jay-Z, like, over time, being able to evolve and stay cool and shit, like, I think he's the greatest, man. So,
and, you know, as far as press, you know, you've gotten a lot of critical love, a lot of critical attention, but also I saw a couple of really nasty reviews.
There's one.
Over
there's one dude who's
there's
like,
the one 20. I think 2011, the Daily Planet guy.
Yeah,
the Daily
dude,
Planet
he is
guy.
Such a small dude. He's such a small time dude, but we were like, we love this, and so we like. We like threw it out and like that gets so much attention, you know what I mean? So
yeah, so when you read something like that, I guess my question is like, how do you react? So for people who haven't seen it, we'll link it on the show notes. He calls your music rap at its worst.
Yeah.
In an article entitled Prof's King Gompo is Rap at Its Worst, published in the Twin Cities Daily Planet in 2011, Dwight Hobbs writes the following. Prof's King Gompo is asinine, narcissistic self-indulgence run completely riot without a shred of redeeming artistry. When this knuckle-dragging Neanderthal isn't waxing vulgar enough to turn a buzzard's stomach, he's breaking an arm, patting himself on the back with self-congratulations for being a white man. Particularly a white man boldly going where mostly black men have gone before as a ghetto-spawn phenomenon. It's enough to make you wonder just how much worse things can get, how much more rap can degenerate into a base, ruthlessly appropriated ripoff of the legitimate groundbreaking art form it started out as. Suck a dick, snuffleupagus,
nothing but freaks in the room. I'm like, this dude must be a fucking idiot. Like, can you hear, like, this, the wordplay, the syllables, and just, like, any of that shit, you know? Like, I don't know. I think he just listened to, like, two songs, and he heard, like, maybe, probably, you know, 500 things that offended him in the first two songs, and was like, fuck this. And he, you know, he's old as hell, you know, and he was like, I can't listen to this music anymore. I mean, it's my fucking job. Like, if I made music that would, like, my old ass fucking grandma would like, man, I wouldn't be doing my job. Like, I'm not making music for dudes or people in their 50s or 60s, you know? It's like, and I'm not nothing new either. Like, fucking, you know, like, every single genre of all time has done this, and the newer generations came up and been fucking a little edgy, you know what I'm saying? It happened in jazz and fucking punk rock, and it's like, it's forever.
Yeah, well, it's funny. We were talking about Luke Campbell before we were on air, and some of the stuff around your videos and some of your songs, I think, kind of brings me to mind to some of the early Two Live Crew, I think, at least in terms of image, if not mm-hmm. music.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's nothing new either. I'm like, people are like, man, your ego, like, I'm like, newsflash, like, a rapper thinks he's fucking good. I'm like, get something else to talk about. Like, of course I think I'm good. Like, why would I be here in New York trying to do this? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I wanted to talk to you about some of your art, cover art choices.
Yeah.
Some questions about it. First off, like the Kaiser von Powderhorn 3.
Yeah,
man. Sort of an homage to Pen and Pixel.
Yeah.
Pen and Pixel is a Houston graphic design firm who were, for a long time, the in-house artists for the famous No Limit Records label. The firm is well known for its use of 3D and effects-laden text to make album titles and artist names look like they were made of diamonds, gold, or other kinds of jewelry. These typically overlay a scene depicting the album artist, who was frequently surrounded by women, cars, heavy weaponry, alcohol, drugs, or anything else that made sense. Notable examples of their style are Master P's The Last Don, Mystical's Ghetto Fabulous, Snoop Dogg's The Game Is To Be Sold, Not Told, and the absolutely has to be seen to be believed cover of Big Bear's Doin' Things. Prof's Kaiser von Powderhorn 3 looks like it could have come from the studio, except when you look closer, the women are all very pregnant, Prof is wearing a neck brace, and the vehicles in the background are a minivan and a cash-filled stroller. Yippee-ki-yay, your boy is a Kaiser.
Everywhere I go, I'm shitting on them. Diapers, icky, I got you rethinking. We did that. We shot it out. We were like, let's just do like a No Limit cover. You know, just make it nasty. So we make a call out, like, who's the models? You know, are you available these days? And then on Facebook, and we get a hit back. That's like, we're in the office at the same time. And like, Mike's like, yo. He's like, ah. This chick was like, I would love to model for you, but I'm 8 months pregnant, or like 9 months pregnant. And we were like, ha ha. We were like, wouldn't that be funny? Just, hey, let's switch it out. Like, are you pregnant? Are, you know, do this and that. And then we'd like stop laughing and looked at each other like, yo, let's do that. So scratch that, delete that post, shout out, who's fucking 9 months pregnant right now? Who's ready to get in a bikini and some high heels? And then everybody, like, it was in the cards, man. They all filed in and was like, it was the craziest photo shoot, man. I'm in there with, like, literally, like, everybody's over nine months or more, and they're all in bikinis, and the estrogen is just, like, seeping through every single crevice. You know what I'm saying? It's just leaking. The love in there was fucking intense, dude. It was so beautiful. It was like, girls, look at your body. You feel great. And I'm like, I feel great. You know, like, this is amazing. Like, there's a couple shots that didn't make it when we all laid on the ground.
Yeah.
And I'm in the middle of fucking seven or eight just pregnant women in skin to skin. Like, there's like other animals I can't see that are living that are like piled underneath all this flesh. You know what I'm saying? And it was great.
That's amazing. And then you had the King Gumpo cover based on Gummo.
Yep,
based on the movie Gummo.
Yeah, I love that shit. I'm a fan of those ideas. I'm a fan of moments of that movie. You know, I think timing and stuff and how it's edited might be a little bit better. Like, I wouldn't sit and watch that a billion times, but some of that shit is priceless, groundbreaking, new. Like, when they actually get those two brothers fighting in that room and shit.
Oh, fuck. Shit, man. Give me them shoes. So what's for dinner, man? You cooking tonight?
You know, they actually get real people drunk wrestling with chairs. Like, that just spoke to me at the time.
There's a thread that kind of runs through probably half a dozen of your songs, maybe more, where you call yourself an animal.
Abracadabra, I'm an animal. Why is everybody gotta dance on mechanical? Fucking incredible. I am such an animal. Work ethic unimaginable.
What does that mean to you? Like, why do you keep coming back to that particular image or metaphor or whatever?
It's real to me. It's like, it's real. And I love animals, dude. I love drawing and painting animals. I'm a visual artist. I've done most of the work that you've seen, all those covers and stuff. Like, a majority of that I designed and do all my posters still. I want to stop that shit because I don't got time for that shit anymore.
Yeah.
But, like, if I got time, I'll go at home and I'll paint an animal. Like, I love animals. And it's real to me. Like, it's human to me, you know, because we're animals. You know, like, I hear people talking, like, a lot of this fucking, you know, don't blow up or go mainstream and shit. Like, I talked to someone the other day and they're like, man, if I blow up, I'm going to sell out right away. I'm going to get all this money and shit. I'm like, I just laughed. I was like, man, that is so human. Like, you are not a machine. You know, you're vulnerable to this and that. Like, that is more human than a lot of this fucking, you know, true school hip hop shit is like so fucking robotic to these fucking laws. You know what I'm saying? You know, I just think it's a little bit wider and just it is who we are, man. We're just animals out here.
And you have a couple rap name things. You know, we went to art. I want to talk to names. Where did Kaiser von Powderhorn come from?
Came from Powderhorn. Kaiser von Powderhorn was a dog of mine.
Listen, women, Kaiser von Powderhorn is up in your kitchen.
And so in the 90s, Powderhorn was nothing nice. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was fucking getting picked on. I mean, that was a culture at the time. You know, it was a black neighborhood. The fucking anger was real. Like, it was a result of, you know, fucking real systematic oppression, fucking housing the markets, and motherfuckers were angry, you know?
But it's hard to take all that in at 8 years old or whatever.
Yeah, so I was getting jumped all the fucking time. Like, I couldn't ride my bike, you know, even the fucking, I was getting fucking beat up, you know? And so I was like, what the fuck am I going to do? Like, I started hanging out with some fucking gully motherfuckers who accepted me. And, you know, handing me this knife, I'm like, I gotta fucking stab someone. Like, I gotta be the hardest if I gotta be out here, you know, or else I gotta fucking stay inside all the time. And I remember just like thinking about this, you know, for a long ass time. Like, I gotta fucking kill somebody, you know what I mean? Or I can't go out. Like, what do you want to do? And then at this time, we got a big ass dog, a big ass German Shepherd, and the family named it Kaiser von Powderhorn because Powderhorn is, I guess, some German name or something from back in the day. I don't know. And so we named him King of Powderhorn, Kaiser von Powderhorn. He was fucking huge. And, well, he grew up to be enormous, and he was a fucking German Shepherd. And he wasn't going to take any shit. So I could walk around the park with this big-ass dog, you know. And he happened to be a purebred white German Shepherd. So I don't want to bring this race into it or anything like that. So that was weird, but you knew, like, he was recognized all around, like, and he was angry as fuck. So it wasn't like a normal German Shepherd where this dude was shining like a fucking prince, you know? So I'd walk in being like, and they would go out to the other side of the block and shit. So that's where I got that swag from. And, you know, that's like my persona doing those mixtapes, those guys from Powderhorn, like, I'll just eat you, you know, I'll kill you, you know?
Yeah. And Prof, your actual name, where did that?
That came from basketball, a basketball name, a friend of mine. We played all the time, and it was short for prophecy. So, you prophecy, and then you just call me prof. And then I didn't like prophecy. Then I just went with prof, and he would just call me prof all the time. And so I was like, all right, then that's it. I don't think it's a good name at all. I mean, if I fucking came out now, I'd change that shit. You know, I think it's kind of boring. I think it's close to proof. I just think it's weird, you know. But sonically, how it sounded, prof, it is weird personality. It just fell into me, you know.
And, you know, when I was listening...
There it is for you.
Nice. There we go. Live on mic. So Karma is a song of yours I really liked. For people who haven't heard it, you know, the narrator of the song kind of uses, if I'm reading it right, like the violence that was done to him as an excuse for doing violence onto other people.
I'm feeling like shit from my daddy, so tomorrow I'ma fuck with that fat bitch Cassie. She'll cry in front of the mirror when she gets home, have herself a daughter, and make sure she gets pissed on. Similar to why my papa got his wrist blown, found him up north in the tub with the kids gone.
Mm-hmm. Ties into, I think, some of the stuff you were talking about your childhood. Mm-hmm. When you wrote that, did you envision the narrator as like someone the listener is supposed to like question or
Honestly, I just wrote the narrator as me.
Huh.
It's like people justify doing horrible things to people because it was fucking done to me. You know, someone grows up as with under an alcoholic dad, they'll probably be alcoholic. You know, they'll probably be a piece of shit. So it was just written as me, I guess, and me justifying the bad things I've done. I mean, I used to pick on a fat girl named Cassie for real on the bus stop, you know, and I feel like shit about that, you know, and like she'll probably pick on her fucking children because of that. I picked on her because my fucking dad tried to fucking, we found him in a bathtub in Duluth fucking with his wrist split, you know, like, so it's just karma just falling through. It's, you know, perpetuation of violence in these communities. You know what I mean?
And Motor is another song that stuck out to me that's, you know, about your inability to trust people, your desire to escape from situations where it looks like people, you know, may want to be around you or care about you.
But every once a while, a woman touched me, turned me into child. I could fall asleep for now. When it's morning time, I leave her drowned. I let her piece it out. Reasons why I'm piecing out, to each his own. I can't relax. I can't sit still. I can't stay in one spot. I'm not a pinwheel.
Now, what inspired you to write that song? Was there like a particular incident where you're like, wow, these are my patterns. I've got to get this out.
Yeah. Fucking hangovers. You know, I mean, in Minneapolis, like I'm like, if I was as famous as I was in Minneapolis everywhere, I'd be fucking world famous. Like, so in Minneapolis, it's like it I'm starting to see repercussions I didn't know was going to happen. Every single place I go, every single time, someone's looking at me and, you know, judging me, what I'm driving, what I'm wearing, what I'm eating in line at the grocery store. Like, I went on vacation way the fuck out up north, 6 hours away, almost in Canada. I'm having a meal and it's turning into a photo op. I'm taking pictures with the whole staff. I'm sitting down trying to eat and I'm like, oh man, I would just love to be, I came here for a vacation. You know what I'm saying? I kind of love to be away from this. And so like, that's what it is, man. And like, that's happening in Minneapolis right now. It's like, I don't go out like I used to, you know what I mean? I just fucking stay at home. I don't know what the end game is. You know what I mean? It's just get worse and worse. Like Eminem fucking, when he was at Lollapalooza a couple years ago, when I was there with Atmosphere, like he showed up in like 13 or 14 matching SUVs. He left, all the SUVs went in different directions. Like he had to shut down the block, you know. It's just like, what's your definition of success? How far you want to take this? How, you know, I'm starting to develop some sort of paranoia out in public. You know, it's fucking different. When you look at someone, normally you go on your way. Like, I know I can just feel something in a room. I look, it's completely different. And I just know it everywhere I go, and it's hard to relax sometimes. And that's, I think, what Motor's about. You know, it's just trying to be regular again. Like, fucking A, can I just eat well and like relax and, you know what I'm saying, work out and get my body right every once in a while, you know?
Yeah. So that's an interesting spot for you to be in now, where on one hand, you know, you're seeing fame and kind of like the difficult things about it. And on the other hand, you're working 24/7 to try to increase that and take a big step towards it.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely. So, you know, before I would hear famous people be like, oh, you know, and they paparazzi and shit. I'm like, fucking cry me a river. Like, fuck that. But like now I know like that, just that fucking intensity, that energy is like really ugly, you know? So, you know, maybe I just want the money. I don't know. The fame's pretty cool, but I think I already don't really need that. But, you know, fuck it. I do need that because I want to sell out shows. So, and that's, I love doing shows. That's like what I'm best at in life, rather than like, you know, fellatio or whatever.
So you have, when you have people do guest verses on your records, it's often, you know, people might look at the, it's kind of unusual. You had Brother Ali and Riff Raff on the same album.
Religion to recognize that I'm different, can't contain it, grab it, tame it, chain cage or enslave my dedication. I'm floating in my blimp and I'm staring
in the mirror, diamonds crystal clear, man, it's a blimp, blimp, 07 blimp, blimp, I'ma just pull up ice, iceberg 10, bird 10. Yeah.
I think you might be the only person in history to ever have that happen.
I never even really realized that. Yeah.
When you think about having someone on a track, you know, what kinds of things are you thinking about? What kind of things come to mind in terms of who to collaborate with?
I don't know. I really don't think about having people on a track. Like, I'm not like, okay, it's always the beat has to come first. And how do I feel about that? I on this record, fucking Waka Flocka, Petey Pablo and Tech N9ne, like what? Like I didn't sit down and was like, let's put these are my target market. This is my goal here. These three dudes. Like it always happens in the song after I listen to it a bunch of times. I listen to the song a bunch of times and it just pops up fucking randomly, you know, and that's what it is. And I want to cast a huge net and make all types of weird music that makes you feel all types of ways. Like I want to be able to do a track with Riff Raff and Brother Ali. Like I don't want to be stuck in one lane. I'm on all the lanes, you know. I want to do everything. I don't want to be boxed into something, you know. So I want to be able to, in the future, if I do something way out of left field, like, man, I already did it. Like, you know, I don't want permission to try something new. I just want to do it as I go, and the guests kind of reflect that, you know.
And you've talked a lot so far about live performance and, you know, loving shows and all that. How did you get good at playing live? Like, how did you develop as a live performer?
Honestly, man, no one's ever asked me that question. I really do believe I was there at the beginning. I've learned a lot and gotten a lot better, and I can handle a situation where there are only 12 people coming to the show. I can perform in front of 30,000 people. I know how to do all types of shit. You know, I was on a Sway show and he was like, man, like, you really know how to handle yourself. But because of your history, you know, you've been doing this for so long, you don't even need to tell anybody that. You can just step right in there and do it. So I know how to work different rooms and shit, but my desire to be great live was like the very first fucking show. You know, I wanted my intensity, how I want to just focus in on the crowd and be at the same place at the same time as everybody else. Every word is important. Like, I've always been that way, to really, really focus in and try and do my best. It's been a huge focus of mine.
And one thing that I know has been important to your sound that's been talked about a little less is one of Fundo's groups, the DJ Collective, Get Crify.
Yeah, yeah. That was, I would say, parallel with my movement coming up. Like, it was, I want to say anti-Rhymesayers, but it was like party, you know, and Rhymesayers was doing, I mean, they were fucking partying, you know what I'm saying? But they weren't making music about partying as much. And we were out there partying and making music about partying for partiers.
Yeah.
And we were both doing it together, you know? And so I was coming up, Get Crify was throwing these shows. I would go in there and host and just get drunk and throw water and beer on everybody, and it was a good time. So and my music fit with that. They could play my music in there, you know. I could go and host and tell my fans to come, and they'd like it too.
And I saw a promo you did for Liability, a promo video, and you tweeted that it actually got you in trouble with the cops.
What do we got on this robbery business? Ooh. Got a male still inside 2411 Hennepin. Keep the air clear, no weapons seen at this time.
You're nodding like that's true. I thought that might have been a joke.
No. I was talking to Sadiq, one of the CEOs of Rhymesayers. I was talking to Sadiq, and he was like, what? That was real? That audio that we picked up? We paid $15 or something, Sky did, or, you know, paid money to, you can get that audio. So I'm running in and out of there acting with this face mask, and we're doing a promo for all the things you get with, like, the deluxe pack of my record coming out.
Yeah.
And it's dope. It's like a criminal kit, you know? It's got, like, matches, arson, start a fire, you know, be just like my dad. He's got a fucking ski mask to go rob a place, rubber gloves, duffel bag, you know, flask, right. all that shit, mag light. So we were like, let's make a video to show all this shit. And we're like, let's just rob the store. So I go in there, and I don't have a gun or anything, but I'm like pointing. I have a mask on. We're on Hennepin Avenue, which is one of the busiest streets in Minneapolis, and it's rush hour.
Yeah.
So I'm running in and out of there with a mask, like, do the take again, you know? And we weren't really thinking, you know, I guess. And so the timing was pretty crazy. The timing, I was just about to run out again, and Jordan here goes like, wait, stop. I have another idea. Let's have, before we do this, go out here and have the camera behind the angle. And then right when he's saying, wait, like right afterwards, a chick runs down the stairs. She goes, stop. Do not walk outside. Don't move. The police are here. I'm like, what? I was just about to run outside to do the take again. I look over and through the glass, like, they came through, no sirens on, fucking shotguns, pistols out, crawling, edging alongside of the fucking glass, guns out. And I'm sitting there, you know, this storefront is just all glass, you know? So I'm like, oh, and I see them and I'm like, you know, I'm like, hey, there's guns. The guns are out. And I take off my mask. I'm like, dudes, bros, like, you know,
yeah,
don't shoot me. So that on that video promo, we edited in the real fucking audio of the police scanner. That's on that video promo. That was really them talking and describing
me. That's really them talking about you.
And describing me as I broke in. Yeah. So it worked. I want that video to get more shine because it like came together, you know? So I don't know. What's that video called? Put your hands up, prof, on under the rhyme saver.
Yeah, we'll link to it as well. So you have a tour coming up.
The Liability Tour. It's my first national headlining tour. And we're just going to see what happens, man. We're going to go out there and try and kill it, do what we do. Nacho Picasso's opening up.
She got big ass titties with the round long nipples, about the size of a quarter, or maybe a nickel. I took a pump off a nipple, the coat gave me the sniffles. I put a hand on my pickle, I told her, give me a whittle. Told her, hey,
oh, nice.
I heard he's fucking nasty and crazy, so we'll see if we make it to the end. You know what I'm saying? So, if come to the show quick, it might not ever happen again. You might never see it again.
Nice. And one last thing. I was looking at a video of the homecoming show you did at First Avenue, and I saw you had a giant Flaming Lips style ball that you rolled through the crowd on.
Yeah, man. Why not?
How does one go about making something like that happen?
I go like, hey, let's do this. And then I just want to do fun, crazy shit at shows. And so, you know, I mean, everything has been done already before over and over again. I'm still looking to do something completely original, but I'm like, I want to go in. I just want to be involved. I want to jump in the crowd in all types of different ways and fuck things up, man. The tour is going to be the shit. Yeah. There's going to be a lot of new music. I'm really excited for it.
How was the ball thing to actually do?
You got to get in there and then I don't know. It's kind of awkward, man, to tell you the truth. It's like hard to do. It takes like 45 seconds. So like as I'm getting in there and it's like inflating again, like, you know, we're playing this music that's like building up. But we timed it out pretty well, and I jumped out there.
Nice.
I had knee surgery the next day or some shit.
Amazing. Well, Prof, Liability should be out by the time you hear it on Rhyme Sayers. Thanks for coming by.
Grab the record, man. Thanks for having me.
Conversations on this show can go a lot of ways. Historic, stylistic, artistic. But rarely do they get as personal as they did with Prof. I'm glad he got a chance to share so much of his story. I think it's very clear that he's far more than the one-dimensional party animal some critics, or at least one particular critic, make him out to be. Join us next week when our guest will be Paul Wall. The Houston rapper was one of the key figures in his city's journey from hip-hop's outskirts to its mainstream in the mid-2000s. He also has a long-running, successful second hustle as a jeweler and maker of custom grills. We talk about Swisher House's run at the top of the charts, the time one of his grills got banned from the Olympics, and much, much more. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas you have for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and show notes, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
The estrogen is just like seeping through every single crevice.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I love drawing and painting animals. If I got time, I'll go at home and I'll paint an animal. Like, I love animals.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I still have goosebumps on my arms. Like, you could see my goosebumps on stage.
Special thanks to our largest Patreon supporter, Vikram.
I'm seeing my balls all over the internet and shit.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Like leaving a therapy session. Good.